comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm. Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hodgson Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks. Folks, welcome to another episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo. I'm here today with Mr. Chris Doyle and Mr. Dan Kelly. Chris is a partner in the State and Local Tax Group, as is Dan Kelly. Chris is our practice area leader for the SALT Group at Hodgson Russ. He's a UB School of Law grad, and he is licensed to practice in New York. And Dan is a UB School of Law grad as well, but is also an undergrad alum of my alma mater, Syracuse University. Go Orange. And Dan is licensed to practice law in California, New York, and Florida. Folks, we're going to do something a little different here today, and this is going to be the start of something that I think will be really great for the show and for you listeners, and it is called the Happy Minute. The Happy Minute is something that has origins at a dive bar in Youngstown, New York. I believe it's called The Jug. Is that correct, Chris?
Yes, the Ontario House Hotel.
And it's a name that we've adopted for times when we like to sit around and have philosophical conversations about tax law, its nuance, its policy. And while we are having those philosophical, intelligent, academic, even some would say, conversations, we typically engage in the consumption of certain beverages, typically in the beer family.
True, but not exclusively. You know, sometimes there's brown liquor there. Joe has his vodka bottle that he brings out. And of course, Añejo tequila.
Yes.
I think is Joe's drink of choice.
This is something that we do, and we thought it would be a fun thing to integrate into the show so that our listeners could see and hear, rather, some of the lighter side of tax law, or I guess not even the lighter side of the law, but rather the lighter side of those who practice it and discuss it. And these are an extension of real conversations that we have all the time and some insight into perhaps the way our minds work when we're not all buttoned up in front of a judge or presenting on a stage. So Chris, Dan, thank you for joining me for the first of what I feel will be many of these types of episodes. Today, our topic, our starting topic is the convenience of the employer rule in New York. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the convenience of the employer rule, it is a persnickety rule that causes non-residents of New York State trouble when it comes to the taxation of their salary and other W-2 type compensation. First, I should, I guess, say that let's talk about salary for a second. The way that salary is allocated for a non-resident is based on the proportion of your New York workdays over your total workdays throughout the earning period. New York's convenience rule is going to treat days worked remotely by a non-resident who is assigned to a New York office as New York workdays for purposes of this allocation fraction. So the numerator goes up, the denominator stays the same, higher percentage of New York workdays, more tax paid to New York. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, I think you've got it covered.
This is a rule that, for lack of a better term, is quite annoying. And it gets a lot of non-resident taxpayers in trouble, particularly because they may not necessarily know that it even exists. They think they've gotten out of New York. They think they've changed their domicile. They are all set to not pay another dime to New York State, and then bam, they're hit with this convenience rule because they're a remote employee and they're paying taxes to New York and they're asking themselves, why did I move in the first place and go through all this hassle, get my stuff, get a new place, et cetera, et cetera. I'm still paying tax to New York. Something we hear kind of all the time. And don't fret, folks, because there are ways around it. We're going to discuss some of those, but we're going to start off just with a more general conversation about, you know, the convenience rule and fairness and public policy. And with that, I'll turn it over to the professor for some initial comments.
Sure. So from a policy perspective, I think that it is accurate to say that every state is permitted and typically does tax its residents on all of their income. And everybody thinks that that's okay because if you live in a state, the state should be able to get everything. Now, at the same time, if you are a multi-state employee working in a variety of different jurisdictions, your resident state will typically give you a resident credit. We've already mentioned that. At the same time, states are entitled, in addition to taxing their residents, they're entitled to tax non-residents, including non-resident corporations or non-resident business entities, on the income earned in the state. They can't tax everything. They can just tax what is earned in the state. And from a policy standpoint, that also seems pretty fair. Like if you're in our state using our services, taking advantage of our markets for your services or products, you should be, you know, subject to at least, you know, paying for that privilege. All of that makes perfect sense to me. But then states like New York in this instance with respect to the convenience rule, but other states, they try to layer in these unique aspects to their tax systems that, you know, try to get maybe just a little more than what they deserve. And as you already mentioned, it's annoying, but what is really sort of surprising for a lot of taxpayers is that, you know, not every state has similar rules. Like it's not uncommon for there to be, you know, there's 50 states, maybe 20 different rules for determining what salary is allocated to a particular state if you're a non-resident. You know, it could be days in, days out. If you're talking about, you know, RSUs or stock option compensation, it could be based on work days in, work days out during a compensatory period that looks at grant to vest or grant to exercise. You know, there's even within that sort of fairly, arcane universe, there's two different rules for determining how RSUs or stock options are allocated to a state. And there are other types of income, too, that attract other types of allocation methodologies. If it's business income instead of salary income or wage income, you can use a three-factor formula that looks at property, payroll, and receipts in a particular state, or there are receipts-only type allocation methodologies. The real sort of problem for taxpayers and the real benefit for tax lawyers like us is that there's, you know, no two states have exactly the same rule. And that means that I'll have a job until I retire. And at the same time, it means that it's, you know, frustrating to taxpayers who at a greater frequency now than ever can work wherever they want. You know, they don't have to work, you know, in their office. They don't have to work in the same state that their office is located in. They could even work in a different country than their office is located in. And it, you know, results in like sort of weird, unforeseen circumstances that, you know, can bite taxpayers in the butt.
I think a lot of New York tax policy and law is kind of look back at the reasons behind why rules like this are established or whether enacted. New York is such an interesting place where, I don't know the actual statistics, but I think pre-COVID, the population of the five boroughs swells by millions of people per day. They come from Pennsylvania, they come from New Jersey, they come from Connecticut, they come from planes all across the country and world, and they go back at night someplace else. And so the idea is, well, all these people are leaving and coming every day and working in New York, but going home someplace else. You know, if they're working from someplace else, if they're working when they go home or working on the weekends, you know, can they massage, like Joe mentioned at the beginning, that denominator of the source fraction? New York workdays stay stagnant, out-of-state workdays maybe go up, thus reducing the New York allocation percentage. And so you look at that and say, you know, even from a New York residency perspective, your income allocation perspective, what other city in the world or country, maybe not the world, I don't know, but at least in the United States can say that, where people are flooding across borders on ferries, on trains, on cars every day to work here only to go home someplace else. It's an interesting kind of, you look at New York and say, hey, maybe they're more aggressive than California. They're more aggressive than some other state who doesn't have a convenience test. But part of it's probably more of necessity just because of how unique our, you know, kind of economy is relative to other places.
I think you're right on that point. And it's definitely, and we're going to talk in a little bit about one of the major court cases that has attacked this convenience rule, but there's absolutely a uniqueness to New York State, and most of that is derived from Manhattan and the five boroughs, and they almost need to operate as an independent jurisdiction, and sometimes the entire state reflects not just the tax policy, but the political policy of what New York City would have independently because it is so uniquely situated, both geographically and economically, where it's like, I can never remember the statistic, but it's something like New York City is like one of the world's largest economies or something like that, which, again, all makes sense. And when you think about it from that perspective, it starts to get easier to understand perhaps the underpinnings of why a law like this was passed in the first place. And what's interesting here is we're going to talk about it in the context of the law in 2003, because that's when the court case, the Zelensky matter that we're going to chit-chat about, was kind of brought before the tribunal and the Court of Appeals. But things are different now. COVID happened. We experienced, for me as a millennial, it's like my eighth paradigm-shifting event, never going to happen again in my lifetime type event. But we live in a different world post-pandemic, truly. And I think one of the things that it has affected the most, without a doubt, is the way that business is conducted. Primarily that business does not need to be conducted in a physical location anymore. We have learned and we have adapted to the remote world, and we can operate from anywhere for most people. That obviously is not applicable to every single job. But so the influx of people and ferries and cars and doubling the population of Manhattan that you kind of alluded to a few moments ago, Dan, may still be happening to some extent, but it does not necessarily need to happen in, 2022, 2023 and on a going forward basis. And I think that this rule now is under the microscope again. And one of the reasons that we're talking about it is because things are different. And we saw it with the New Hampshire versus Massachusetts case that made it almost to the Supreme Court, to the front door before getting kind of kicked to the side, that there are states that may have not had a rule like this before. And I think it's only six jurisdictions, six states that have a rule like this, that maybe they want to employ a rule like this or need to employ a rule like this in the future because people are more mobile and people are leaving, at least from New York, en masse. And I think there are other high tax states where that may follow. And other states might be like, whereas before it was a rule that was perhaps rooted in, we are just different. We are different than everywhere else and we need our rules to comply with the way that things are here. Now maybe it's, oh crap, everybody's running away because we're taxing the hell out of them and we need to extend our arm as far as we can to get some of that money back so that our revenue doesn't absolutely go through the floor.
I don't know if we're talking about like a ring on a tree where things change again with this remote work thing, just because keeping a light pulse on it, a lot of employers want their people back with butts in seats, for new jobs and for existing jobs. It's like, come on back. And so I think a lot of people and a lot of forward-thinking companies will allow people to work remotely. So it's, to be determined on if it's as big of a shift as we saw with, kind of shut down offices and those types of things, if it's going to be as pervasive. But yeah, I mean, it's just such an interesting test for New York in particular. I know there's a few jurisdictions that have this or impose this type of convenience rule doctrine during the pandemic, during the state of emergency, like plus 90 days, like in the case of Massachusetts. I personally am not a fan of the convenience test from a number of perspectives, not only because it affects our clients negatively, but because from a fundamental perspective, it just doesn't sit right with me. Just kind of irritates me that folks can be, physically working from some other location and benefiting from all of the, kind of aspects of that state that they're sitting in. And that state probably has a physical presence-based rule because most of the 40 other states or whatever it is use physical presence. Only to kind of have this boomerang where the workday comes back to New York or comes back to Arkansas or comes back wherever it's coming back to. That's my own opinion. That won't change the regulation. But yeah, I'm personally, you have to deal with it, have to plan around, have to think about it, but just not a big fan.
I'm with you on that too. I think like to me, the rule has always kind of stunk of unfairness. And there's like unfairness in the legal sense where like we get in front of a judge and present some grand, perfect kind of Platonian version of fairness.
Joe,
and
then what's Platonian mean?
Like, you know, like
from Plato.
From Plato, yeah.
Like what my kid builds with? Like purple and orange.
I think that's Platonian.
Okay. I was not a Latin scholar, so these two aristocrats in here. You know.
But I think like so there's that version that like let's get real philosophical and grandstand and present like the Oxford Dictionary defines fairness as that, you know, lawyers are paid tons and tons of money to come up with. And then there's the like the real person version of fairness where it's like, okay, I got a job with a company in New York and I went into New York maybe 10, 15 times this year. A couple of them were like retreat days or mandatory training, but for, you know, 300 plus days I was working in another state and somehow I'm paying taxes to New York on all of the income. Like, it's just like, I guess it's like the working man's sense of unfairness of like, how can it be this way, right? Like, and that's the way it always resonated with me. It was just like, what's the Supreme Court line about pornography? Like, you know, when you see it, yeah, this is like a, you know, when you see it type of unfairness to me.
So let me give some context and then ask a question of you both. The context comment is this: over the last 10 or 15 years, more and more states are at the business level going to single factor receipts only apportionment. So that you allocate your income to a state if you're a business based on where you earn your receipts. All your receipts are in the denominator and your state-specific receipts are in the numerator. And along with that change has been a change to treat the receipts for services in particular, the receipts in the numerator as being the receipts that are allocated to the market state. So where your customers are located, right? Do we think that that's a fair rule? That's my question, my first question.
So that market-based sourcing per se has not struck me as unfair. Insofar as before that corporation or business entity, whatever it is, has a sufficient nexus to be hauled into tax in that state where its market is. I know that there's the kind of extremes of the permutation is you have customers in the 46 states that have tax or whatever it is, you know, and therefore you could have to file in those states and sub-jurisdictions. Market-based sourcing makes sense to me insofar as you're receiving payments from someone who gets the benefit of your services someplace else. And I can see the kind of corollary where it's like, well, you know, that's not where our people are sitting. People are sitting in New York. Why are we sourcing that receipt to Texas or to Illinois?
Exactly. I'm going to draw the connection between the convenience rule and market-based sourcing. If your market is your employer, then why shouldn't your salary be attributed or sourced to the location of your employer?
Well, your employer has in some cases, found it more beneficial if you did not have a desk in their office in New York and to sit in your own home, you know, in your pajamas or not, to work for them, you know? So it, from one perspective, it's like your employer is probably saving money by having you wherever you are and not having an office and a badge. But I think more interestingly, just in terms of what the employment relationship is, there's a juxtaposition with the New York Convenience Desk where, if done correctly, so unemployment insurance or reemployment insurance is not allocated typically like salary, right? So one state gets that tax or that, you know, withholding by the employer. And very often, if that employee is localized, let's say in a state like Florida, that employee will have UI or reemployment insurance in Florida withheld in Florida, but then pay income tax to New York. Like you know, Florida acknowledges them as a Florida-based employee. If they get fired, they look to Florida, not to New York, to get their compensation. You know, so it's just, I totally get your point that you maybe your client as an employee is your employer or your boss or whoever it might be. It just still strikes me as maybe more nefarious, but perhaps I haven't given it enough kind of comparative thought to the whether market-based sourcing has the same evils, you know, but it seems wrong in the employment context of someone who's making perhaps much less money than the corporation as a whole to have to kind of subject to these rules.
Yeah, and I think I think that the comparison you're about to make is going to be a fair one from a legal standpoint, but I think I just keep going back to exactly what I just said. Like, you, it's my, you know, when you see it, and like, to me, it's like, well, we're talking about a person, not a business. Like, a person's employer is not their client in the same way, or their customer in the same way that like businesses generate revenue from customers, from their sales. Like, I don't know, I would never think like, oh yeah, had a great day today and my, you know, my customer paid me for the work I did for them and that's my, you know, my boss.
Like, yeah, like Hudson Russ is your, yeah, is your customer.
Exactly. Like it is analogous in a certain extent, but if you drill in at a high level of detail, it's like, well, person's not a business. There's a reason we have different rules for, you know, corporations from individuals.
So there are absolutely differences, you know, from a practical standpoint. All corporations and businesses get to apportion their income. They don't have to ask for a resident credit, right? So with individuals, you're typically taxed on 100% of your income by a state, and you get a credit for taxes paid to another state. Businesses often allocate income to states where they don't have a nexus. So they're typically paying tax on something less than 100% of their income. So that's something that might affect your, you know, your fairness goggles. All right. The other question I would have is, if it were 38 states that had convenience rules instead of 6 or 5, would that change your mind about the fairness of it?
Personally, no. Because for me, the fairness is not related to the frequency of states that have such a... Let me put it this way. There are a lot of laws that a lot of states have that I disagree with, and if more states had those same laws, it wouldn't make me disagree with them less.
I would say maybe something similar, where I think it'd probably be best if states just disregarded this idea, but I would say I would find it less offensive if that was the case. And the reason is because one of the kind of more nefarious ways in which this thing rears its head is not so much people in Florida, because it still really stinks for people in Florida, because, you know, it should not apply to them in many instances. It's people in other states that have a strict physical presence rule, and they draw their resident credit based on their own state's interpretation of what a workday is. So, you know, you see it pop up on the West Coast in many states. You see it pop up in most states that have an income tax. In Connecticut before 2019, where, you know, the state is saying, hey, I don't care what kind of wacky rule New York has that sources these days that you are in my state working to New York. I don't care about that. I care about my rule. And my rule says that if you're in my state working, that's a my state workday. You don't get a credit because it's not New York source income. And so there's where you start to have situations where taxpayers are paying tax, like a corporation can in a worst case scenario, on more than 100% of their income. In theory, you're like kind of locked in at 100. Maybe the other state's higher rate, but you know, when you have a situation where you have asymmetry in a convenience test state and a non-convenience test state that you're resident in, you can wind up with 150 or 200 or more than 200% tax paid to a state and local government, if you're looking at a state like California potentially, which is just like a doomsday scenario. So if states all kind of banded together, it still would not have the same outcome, I think. I wouldn't like it, you know, kind of to Joe's point, but I would feel better about it.
I think that's like, it's a fair point. Like, impact would be lessened, but it's kind of like, all that's running through my head right now is like, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, does it still make a sound? Like, if a bad law impacts you but a good law gives you relief, is it still a bad law, right?
Yeah.
Folks, we're going to take a pause here and circle back in part 2 of this episode. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans. The comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm.